74, count them. It's been a long time. At the end of last semester, we talked about why we concentrate on physical organic aspects of chemistry rather than preparative synthetic chemistry. But synthetic chemistry is a big deal. And for those, the reason to do that is that I think it's more generally interesting. The synthetic stuff has lots and lots of lore in it. And if you need that lore, you'll learn it when you take further courses and practice the art. But it's really an interesting art. And so today I want to give you a little bit of flavor of that in the context of cortisone synthesis, which is not a new synthesis. This was done in 1951. But it shows how synthesis is done by a master, Robert Burns Woodward. And it serves as a review for the things we've been doing. So I'll ask you for help along the way. Last semester, so cortisone is what we're talking about, and much of this is based on a passage in Advanced Organic Chemistry by Fieser and Fieser, which was published in 1961. And when I took elementary organic chemistry, Louis Fieser was my teacher. You notice he's smoking a cigarette here. He was on the Surgeon General's commission about smoking and health that put the things on the cigarette packs by law and so on. So he became in his last years a real crusader against smoking, but it did him in anyhow. He was a very important synthetic chemist and teacher of both synthetic chemists and of general chemistry. He taught elementary organic chemistry almost every year. He wrote a lot of textbooks. So anyhow, the story of cortisone relates to the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine in 1950, where these three guys, Kendall, Reichstein, and Hensch, got it for their discoveries relating to the hormones of the adrenal cortex, their structure, and biological effects. So Kendall and Reichstein were chemists who worked on this, even though Kendall was at the Mayo Clinic, and Hensch was a physician. So this is a little extract from Hensch's Nobel address. He says, "The air of pessimism regarding the rheumatic disease in general and rheumatoid arthritis in particular still finds expression in some of the modern writings and texts, at least modern as of 1950 when he got the Nobel Prize." And then there's a paragraph here on ameliorating effect of jaundice on rheumatoid arthritis. "It was this gloomy tradition that beginning about 1923, I served my rheumatologic apprenticeship. But in April 1st, 1929, notice it's April Fool's Day, a 65-year-old patient at the Mayo Clinic told me an unusual story. A few days before that date, he was painfully affected by rheumatoid arthritis, as he had been for 4 years. Then jaundice suddenly developed, and within a week, most of his arthritic manifestations had disappeared. The jaundice lasted 5 weeks, but the rheumatoid arthritis did not relapse until several weeks after the jaundice had disappeared. The thought occurred, instead of being relentlessly progressive, this disease, rheumatoid arthritis, might be potentially reversible, more so than we have believed, perhaps rapidly so. So during the next 5 years, observations were made on 16 patients with chronic arthritis in whom jaundice of different types and degrees developed. If the jaundice was deep enough and was characterized by bilirubinemia and the direct reacting type, the rheumatic symptoms quickly diminished or disappeared for varying lengths of time, days to months, and then gradually returned." So then he tells how they started taking things out of people that had jaundice and injected it in other people with arthritis, and nothing worked. They could turn them yellow, but they couldn't make them lose the arthritis. But there was another lead. It was also occasionally noted that pregnancy sometimes temporarily checked the disease. Notice that was as early as 1890 that this was noted. In summary, the conflicting and confusing opinion stated that rheumatoid arthritis may be precipitated by or first appear during pregnancy, and that it may be aggravated during or relieved partially or completely by pregnancy, or that the disease is unaffected by pregnancy but aggravated by the postpartum state. No critical investigation appears to have been undertaken to clarify these confusions. So at the Mayo Clinic, they saw patients who had become pregnant while they had arthritis. It was observed observed that most of them, not long after the onset of pregnancy, had an undramatic and slowly progressing development of relief from their arthritic disability. So they thought there must be something common to pregnancy and jaundice, some factor they called X that would be effective in arthritis. Okay, so then the chemists got involved, and this is Reichstein in his Nobel address. He was at Basel in Switzerland, and there were a lot of the drug companies are a big thing in Switzerland. That's one of the main enterprises in Switzerland. So they do. There's a lot of pharmaceutical research and a lot of academic research related to pharmaceuticals. So anyhow, Reichstein says he took 1,000 kilograms of adrenal glands from cattle and went through a big extraction and got reduced it to 1 kilogram of a particular dry residue. So you do this, you know, grind it up, soak it with this stuff, filter, extract, and so on. Okay, the activity, and of course, at all stages, they trace which fraction has the activity that helps relieve arthritis. In I think it's in dog. Actually, it's not arthritis. Dogs would have their adrenal glands removed, or rats, and then they'd see whether injecting this stuff would help them. And so they got it down to 25 grams by careful distributive operations. That means extraction, which you've done in lab, without noticeable loss of activity. Further separating experiments by physical methods, like extraction or attempts to crystallize, although it was a mixture, you couldn't crystallize it, always gave a distribution of activity among several fractions. So there were several things in there that were doing it. On the other hand, chemical methods were more successful. Now, so they started with 1,000 kilograms, got it down to 1 kilogram, then 25 grams, and then by a chemical way, they were able to get it down to 7 to 8 grams. And the chemical way was to use this brand new reagent, which hadn't been published yet, that was discovered in Paris, called Girard's Reagent T. And it was a way of separating ketones from other things. Now, if you had an acid, how would you separate it from other things that weren't acids in lab? What do you do? Pardon me?
Dissolve it in an aqueous layer.
How do you make an acid dissolve in an aqueous layer? You did this in lab probably many times, right? You separated things by extraction. Yeah, Matt? Right, you make the salt. You treat it with base so the thing becomes an ion. Then it goes into water, and then you can separate it from the things that will be. How about if it were a base? What do you do to separate it from other things? Treat it with acid, it becomes an ammonium salt. So let's have you design Girard's reagent T. You want something that will react with a ketone and make it dissolve in water. So what's going to make it dissolve in water? Charge. So you want something that bears a charge and will keep that charge. Okay? So can you think of any organic group that has a charge that doesn't lose it just by losing a proton? I mean, in principle, anything could lose a proton and lose a positive charge. But some things wouldn't lose protons. Don? Can't hear. Enolate. No, enolate, you put protons back on and off. That's no trouble. Yeah.
Halogen?
Well, a halogen has a halide, would be negatively charged, but it's not attached to anything. You want to go fishing, right? Something that'll hook the ketone and hold on to it, but then be charged so that it'll go into water. Okay. So you need a fish hook to extract ketones. So you want something that reacts well and holds on to ketones. We talked about a kind of reagent. You might not remember it, but I just wonder whether you might. Yeah. And it has to be something that's reversible, right? You can get it back again. You need the stuff, but you want to extract it in. Okay, so we won't take more time on this. But the idea was to make something that was hydrazine. Remember we talked about the unshared pairs of hydrazine and how it's especially happy when the nitrogen makes a double bond to carbon and so on. You get an allylic unshared pair and so on. So that's the thing that's going to hook the ketone. And then we need an R group attached to the end that has to stay plus. Okay? So what was used in Girard reagent's tea is a tetraalkyl ammonium compound. Right? So it doesn't have a proton that could be lost from the N. Right? In principle, you could lose a proton from the methyl group and make an NC double bond. You could make an NC double bond, but that's not... Actually, you can't even do that in this case. So forget it. That's plus and it's staying plus. Right? Okay, so now, where are we going to get this stuff? Well, we got to put some of its bonds together, so you help me with this. Suppose we want to make that bond. What starting material can you use for that? You see how we're doing this as a review? Yeah?
Enolate?
A what?
Enolate?
You can't make everything from enolates. In the context of what we've been talking about, it's not a bad first guess. But you don't have to look at this long before you see it's not an enolate.
Hydrazine and ester.
Okay, hydrazine and an ester. So you attack the carbonyl with the unshared pair of nitrogen, and the carbon has a leaving group, like an ester. And indeed, that's how it's made. Okay, now, where do you get this stuff from? Let's make that bond. So what's going to be able to make a bond from nitrogen to carbon? Evan? How do you make a bond from nitrogen to carbon? You need a HOMO and a LUMO, right? Where's a HOMO likely to be between this pair of things? Okay, so we're going to take trimethylamine with its unshared pair and use that unshared pair to form this bond and at the same time to get the positive charge. So how is this HOMO of nitrogen going to attack a carbon? You could imagine, let's try the enolate ploy since that seems to be so popular. So we make this into an enolate, right? We start with CH3 and pull off a proton. Okay, so we have a negative charge here on carbon. Is that going to allow us to make the bond to nitrogen? No, why not? Hila? It's two HOMOs. We need something that's a low LUMO on that carbon. Yeah. No, an enol even is, it doesn't have an unusually low LUMO. It's high HOMO that does the trick. Yeah. Ketene, the trouble with a ketene is if you had a double bond here and no ethyl there, no ethoxy, that it would attack the central carbon, not the terminal carbon. Yeah.
You start with a system of conjugated double bonds to lower the LUMO?
I'm tempted to say no. There might be a way of doing it, but it's too labor intensive. There's a much easier way. Yeah. If you had a halide on here, then you could do an SN2 reaction. Okay. Great. Now we have... Yeah, Richard? I can't hear.
Could you use an acid chloride in the first place?
Oh, you can use an acid chloride here and put ethoxide on. Right? That would put the ethyl, but we're not trying to do that yet. We have... Oh, if you had an acid chloride instead of ethoxy here, yeah, you could go on off with that as well, sure. Okay, but now we want to make this bond. Where are we going to get an ester bond? Yeah? Aha, uh-huh. We could have a halide, and notice, so we got this, and now we need to get those two chloride bonds. Where are we going to get those? Anybody know how to make an alpha chloro carbonyl compound? Yeah?
It's chlorination, but you need to have like enol too.
Yeah, you remember you make an acid chloride, enol, and then that reacts with chlorine, right? So it's this. We talked about all those reactions. So you can make this, then you can begin separating these ketones, and they form at different rates, because there are lots of different ketones in there, and they hydrolyze later at different rates. So you can do separations, he did that way too. Okay, so it says that only when pure crystalline homogeneous substances were produced were they tested. as far as possible biologically, but that wasn't the main thing. The main thing they wanted to be sure was that they had enough to get an accurate determination of chemical structure so that they knew what they were dealing with. And this was hard because in those days, before 1950, you had to do this in not by spectroscopy, but by chemical reactions and what could you convert to what and so on and figure out what it was. So anyhow, he found in that 7 grams, he found 29 steroids, right? And if you compare these, you can see there's a lot of similarity. They often just differ in one group someplace among themselves. Now, it turns out that those 5 had been previously known. So their structures had been determined. In fact, there are people in the 1930s who got the Nobel Prize for getting the determining the structure of these, even when they were wrong. Right? They had the wrong structure and they got the Nobel Prize for it. But by this time, the structures were settled. Of those 5. So then if you could convert these into one of these, or one of these into one of these, then you could figure out what the other 24 were. So they did that. And these 6 among those 29 were the ones that carried real activity for this anti-arthritis stuff. And in particular, these 2 were important. And they're cortisone, ketone, and cortisol, the related alcohol, the reduced form. Okay? So cortisol is called 17-hydroxy. There's the number 17 carbon. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 is how it's numbered, but that's not very important. Okay, and notice this one is the same thing, except it's 11-dehydro. So that 11 position has lost 2 hydrogens and has become a ketone. It's been oxidized. So those were the 2 that Effort focused on then. He said in his Nobel address, the introduction of an oxygen atom at that position 11 here is difficult. Right? It's one of the major difficulties in the synthetic production of cortisone. The preparation of this substance from desoxycholic acid still remains a long and laborious way, even when so many improvements to it have been discovered. So lots of pharmaceutical companies, in particular Merck, were working hard at trying to get this cortisone to be used for this purpose. If it is wished to obtain cortisone more simply, there remain 2 ways. One is total synthesis, that is, make it from very simple compounds. And 2, discover a better qualified raw material to use than this desoxycholic acid, a bile acid. Both will be tried. The prospects of a total synthesis are difficult to assess. And he has a footnote there saying that R.B. Woodward referred to the partial synthesis of an acid which is already very closely related to cortisone in 1951 in Boston, Mass. He gives a reference for it. So that's what we're going to talk about, is how Woodward in 1951 was able to effect what's called a total synthesis. That is, not starting from one of those other steroids that's pretty closely related and just change one functional group or another, which might or might not be easy, and depends on having lots of that starting material, that steroid available. Okay, but instead of that, start with simple things. And here's a picture taken from that textbook that I mentioned by Fieser that summarizes this, but we're going to go through it step by step to see that you can actually figure out quite a bit about this, how he did it. So the total synthesis, and total we'll define as we go along. Okay, now these steroids have 4 rings, 6, 6, 6, 5. Right, labeled A, B, C, D. So you obviously don't make the whole thing at once. You make it bit by bit. So the first thing he aimed at was making the C and D rings. Why do I put a question mark on the D ring? Can you see? Yeah.
Because it's 6-membered.
It's 6 and you want 5. So he's got something in the back of his mind about how he's going to make a 6 ring into a 5 ring. And we'll get to that. Okay, so anyhow, that's what he's going to start making first. And what does he have here? He has this double bond that's going to be a handle to allow him to modify D to make it what he wants it to be. And then he has a handle here, which is up here in the product. So that's going to be something that's going to allow him to get that do reactions and get that carbonyl group on C11, which is hard to get to otherwise. Right? And then he has a handle here, that is on that carbon right there that's going to allow him to construct ring B. Okay, so that's what he's going to be aiming for first. You can see that there's a real, that this is a big planning project. There, you know, there are a zillion ways to start from simple materials and get to this, right? So how do you do it? Okay, so this stuff was known and readily available. So one of the main things synthetic organic chemists have is in their brain a comprehensive catalog of what kind of things are available that you can start from and cheap, because you're going to need a lot of it. Okay, so that's known and readily available. And now he's going to try to put this ring D on it. So that's what he puts on. How does he do it? Don? Diels-Alder reaction. Okay. So there we go. Those blue bonds shift around, as we know, and you get that. Now these two groups, when you do a Diels-Alder reaction, are going to be cis to one another. And if you look down here, or here, they have to be trans in the product. So that, does that mean we're out of luck? Or is there some way you can change it from being cis to trans? Anybody got an idea of why that might be able to be changed from cis to trans? The trans is more stable because the rings could both be chairs. They can't both be chairs if those groups are cis. So there's an equilibrium that's going to help us. But is there a path that will allow us to change that? Yeah? Abstract this hydrogen and put it back on again. Why can you abstract it? Sharif?
You can abstract it because it would be stabilized by the carbonyl next door.
What would you call it when you abstract it?
Needle it?
Yeah. Okay. So via the enolate, you get the more stable isomer. Okay, we're on the way. Now, you don't want it to go back again for some reason, so you don't want this carbonyl to stay there. So he's going to do this, make these ketones into alcohols. Is that an oxidation, reduction, or neither? It's going to be a reduction. Can you think of a reagent that might be able to do that? A hydride, lithium aluminum hydride, and that was used. Okay, so we're there. And now, he wants to get over to here, which is getting pretty close to this one. Okay, now so he wants to get from here to here via here. Now, in going from here to here, the only change is that this group changes, right? Does that going to require oxidation, reduction, or neither? Yeah? There's going to have to be a reducing agent for that one. How about going from here to here? Can you see? There's a double bond in the ring, both places. There are attachments to oxygen. Here there's a bond to oxygen. Here there's a bond to oxygen. Here there are two bonds to oxygen. So there are two bonds to oxygen here and two bonds to oxygen here. You don't need oxidizing or reducing to get across there. So maybe acid will do it. Okay? So, acid and water. What's going to happen? Where are you going to start out with acid? Okay, protonate OH group, like maybe that one, and lose water. Okay. Now, but why that one? Why the top OH? Why not protonate this one and lose it? Why not protonate this methyl oxygen and lose methanol? Okay, first, why not protonate this one and generate that cation there? Break this bond. Those electrons go away. We generate that cation where the double bond is. Good cation? Bad cation, sp squared, right? Don't want to break that one. Okay, so we're not going to do that one. How about this one? If we protonate there and lose it and generate a cation there, anything good about that? Okay, well, once I've lost that, but originally that there was an OH up there. Oh, it's already positive because it's got an O on it. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so but it would at least be allylic, right? But so is the top one. But the top one is not only allylic. What else? It's got an oxygen on the end, right? So you got more stability when you lose the top. So you lose the top one. Okay. But then you can put water back on again, or the hydroxide back on again. It's an allylic rearrangement. It went from here to here. Right? Now, what functional group do we have now after the allylic rearrangement? What do you call this functional group? Pardon me? It's a heavy acetal. And what do heavy acetals do with acid and water? They lose methanol, right? You protonate the methanol, it goes away. Plus, lose the proton, double bond. So we didn't need an oxidizing or reducing agent, just acids getting us there. Now, for this one, it's going to be a little different. What they do is first treat it with acetic anhydride. So what does an alcohol do with acetic anhydride? Pardon me?
Does it decompose into acetic acid?
Yeah, you get acetic acid and an ester, right? The O here attacks a carbonyl of acetic anhydride, and you have a great leaving group, the anion of acetic acid, right? So it's a substitution at carbonyl, an acyl substitution. Okay, so we get the acetyl group on here, which is now a good what? Leaving group, right? But we still need to do a reduction. We haven't done a reduction yet. So the reducing agent is zinc metal. So zinc comes in and gives its electrons to the carbonyl, and the leaving group leaves. Right? So we got zinc 2 and what? Sharif?
Enolate.
An enolate, right? Or you could draw a bond between the zinc and the O if you want to. Okay? But we got an enolate, sure enough. Okay. And now enolate means you've got a ketone. All you got to do is put a proton on. So we've made it to CD. Or D question mark at least. Okay. Now we're going to start with that and try to get to the next stage, which is to have ring B in there. Okay? Now notice we've changed this double bond to that. That turns out that it's going to be a protecting group for D question mark. So we don't, that double bond otherwise might have reacted, so we have to protect it. Okay, that's what that is. This is a handle to be able to make ring A on there when we need it. Right? We got a carbonyl group there. And we have at least a double bond next to the carbon where we're going to want to get that tough ketone in. Right? C11, remember, is a tough place to put the ketone. But we've got a handle that allows us to get there. So that's what was involved in the design of this. Although it's much, much, of course, more sophisticated and challenging to... And you have to know an awful lot of lore to know what's feasible, what isn't, all the different ways you might get around problems and so on. But anyhow, this is what he's aiming for. Okay, so how does he get toward there? He's got to build this ring, the B ring, onto here. So he's got to make that thing. What kind of functional group do you have here? Alpha beta unsaturated ketone. Does that make anybody think of anything? The aldol reaction, right? But in order to do that, that makes this bond. You have to already have this part on there. So there must have been some way to make this blue bond first, right? And that starts with ethyl vinyl ketone. That's the Robinson annulation that we talked about last lecture. Right, so we make, so there's Robinson, as you remember, and Woodward. Right, so we make what? Sharif?
Enolate
here. And what does it do? What does that enolate do? What does it attack? It attacks here. And what do you call that? You know, you'd think, first, naively, you'd think, oh, it's going to attack the carbonyl. But it attacks here instead. Remember what you call that? Conjugate addition. Michael addition. And the reason is that when you attack here with the anion, make a new bond here, and make the anion there, that's not a bad anion. Why not? Sharif?
Because you have the carbonyl next to it.
And it's... Right. Okay, so you get conjugate addition and get an enolate. Okay? And now you, of course, can protonate that and deprotonate it over there to give an enolate. And what reaction now happens? Yeah, it attacks the carbonyl. And what do you call this reaction that we're doing? It's the aldol reaction, right? So it makes that bond. Okay, so we've got ring B built now. Okay, and now he wants to put two oxygens on. He wants to protect. See, there are lots of double bonds here. And you need to protect some of them so when you're using reagents to get the others, you don't lose the wrong ones. So he's going to do that, and he uses osmium tetroxide. I could have asked you that, but I'm helping you this time, okay? You knew that you could get diols from alkenes with osmium tetroxide. We talked about that one. That's what Professor Sharpless spilled on the bench here once. Okay, and now we need to put this thing in there so that it's no longer an alcohol, so it won't react with things that react with alcohols. So here's carbon, methyl, methyl. How do you put that in? Anybody recognize this functional group? Eric? It's a ketal, or acetal, right? So the reagent was acetone. And it gives this acetal, or ketal, if you like, if you're old-fashioned like I am. Okay, and you know the mechanism for that one. Okay, so we're really quite close here now. What do we need to do? Are we there? Oh, we have to get rid of a double bond here, right? And it turns out that catalytic hydrogenation gets that double bond and not this one, but it would have gotten that one. And if you get that one, then you're in trouble because you don't have any functional group over here to fiddle with in order to change the size of the D ring. So it had to be protected first, right? Okay, so it's protected, and then we got rid of that double bond. Okay, so we got this one. And now we'll make the picture a little smaller just so we can get more on the slide by eliminating the D ring. We're going to work on making the A ring here, and then we'll come back and work on the D ring. So we'll just draw little stubs there. Okay, now, what we're going to aim for next is this. And why? Because this thing is really ready to give ring A. What kind of reaction would convert this into ring A? An aldol. Okay. And this, notice now, is even closer to having the functional group where we're going to need to get that ketone over here on C11 ultimately. Okay, now, so there are alpha hydrogens here. That suggests we can make an enolate. But they're also vinilagous, as they're called, alpha hydrogens here, because if you pull off one of these and make an anion here, now there's a resonance structure which has the anion here, which is obviously an enolate. So this has a vinyl group in between. It's called vinilagous, but it can form an enolate too, and so indeed can this one. This one also is on a carbon adjacent to that. So there are three different enolate kinds of things you could form. Now, what you want is that one. Okay? But it turns out that this one forms more easily, enolate. So you're going to have to do some kind of protecting. Okay? So what they did is to protect the more reactive alpha position by making it and now react it with something that you're going to be able to take off again later. So they use methyl formate, reacts, okay, and then unzips to lose methoxide, and you have the formyl group on that carbon. That's like a Claisen condensation that we talked about last time, the ester, where you attack with a carbonyl and then lose the ester OR group, right? And then that reacts with this thing to give that, which loses water. Okay? So this is itself, this is like an aldol, right, where you add out here and then lose water. Okay? So it's not the same. This thing is an enamine, but it's analogous. So anyhow, that's the protecting group that Woodward chose to use. Having done that, now we can use the base, a catalytic amount of base, and put these three carbons on. Can you see what the reagent might have been that allowed him to put those three carbons on if he had an anion here? An anion on that carbon, and he wants to form this bond to end up with CN. Yeah? It's this, right? It's a Michael addition again. Remember, the cyanide is like a ketone, a multiple bond with an electronegative atom. So this is like adding not to the carbon that has the hetero atom on it, but to the one adjacent here, right? So that's how he made that, a conjugate addition. Okay, but the trouble was he got a mixture of isomers here. That carbon could be either up or down, right? So here's the description of it in the paper, and he noticed that it's a mixture of two isomers, right? That thing. So that's going to be a problem, because now it's not a place where you don't have a hydrogen on that you could pull off, make an enolate, put it back on the other side, right? You can't do that because it's all carbons on there. So you're going to just have to suck it up with that one, and sometime you're going to have to separate it and throw away the stuff you don't want. But this is lore as to whether this is likely to look. People try to analyze. Remember, this is just at the time, 1951, when Barton was at Harvard as a visitor and was talking about conformational analysis and which side you're going to attach. As you may remember, the pictures he first drew were pictures of steroids because that's what people were working on. Okay, so anyhow, there's an enormous amount of lore, and Woodward had the advantage of having a photographic mind. Everything he read, he could remember. Like some student would come and talk to him about something. He said, "Oh yeah, there's a paper about that," and he'd take you down in the bowels of the library where there were a bunch of old journals and take out a book and blow the thing on it and turn to a page he knew, and there it was. So lore was his specialty. Okay. Okay, so now he treat it with strong base, right? And what are we doing here? That removes the protecting group, right? Goes back to the CH2 you had at the beginning because now you've done what you needed to do up above. Okay, and because it's strong, you not only lose that, you also change cyanide into carboxylic acid or the carboxylate anion. Okay, now if you treat that with acid, you get this, fine. Acid will protonate there, which means you have this cation. Can you think what it might attack? Or what might attack it? Where's the HOMO that could attack this LUMO here? Right here. Okay. And now we can lose a proton out here. Bingo. So we've got ring A, right? Matt?
We've got the oxygen.
You got an oxygen instead of carbon there. We need another carbon. So the other carbon, well, for first we do this, generate that cation, lose a proton here, we got that double bond. Okay? Now, it's supposed to be A, but it isn't. Okay? So what they react it with is methyl magnesium bromide. What reagent do you call that?
Grignard
reagent. So it's C minus that's going to attack. Where is C minus going to attack? Here? 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 Here?
Last one.
Why the last one?
This
is the lowest LUMO, the carbonyl. So put C minus on there, and then what would happen? Sharif? Right. This thing will leave because it's an enolate. Okay, bingo. Make that. Unzip to get an enolate, which means you have a ketone, which is what we have here. Now we have enough carbons. How do we get to ring A? Brian, you're my helper on this. Aldol, right? We want to make an alpha-beta unsaturated ketone from this ketone and that one. Okay? Aldol. So now we got A, B, C, and we've got to now, A's all set. So now we got to work on D to make it the right size. Okay, and we're going to aim toward this, which is getting very close to the product. Okay? So first, treat it with acid and water. What's that going to do?
Remove the protecting group,
the ketal or acetal. Okay. Now we've got that, and we're going to break this bond. Now, we actually talked about the reagent that'll do that, and Dr. Ziegler talked about it on Monday, too. Anybody have it off the top of their head? We haven't drilled on this, so I'm not surprised if you don't. Yeah?
Something along the line, like
pyridate. Pyridate, yeah. Okay, so that makes, like, as if this were a carbonyl, this makes a ketal with iodine in it, right? But that one can unzip, right? Which breaks the carbon-carbon bond. Remember, Dr. Ziegler talked about cleaving between two alcohols in order to find out what was linked to what, how many hydrogens there were on carbons and so on. Okay, so this comes apart and you get two aldehydes. Now what are you going to try to do? Right? An aldol reaction. Okay, so you wanted to, here's an alpha-beta unsaturated aldehyde. It's an aldol product and gives ring D, right? But it's not obvious that that's going to work. Can you see why? Can you see something that could have gone wrong? What do you react to do an aldol reaction? What are the two things that come together? You know, a week from today, we're having a final. And you may have inferred that it would be handy to know what the aldol reaction is. Okay, Victor? Right, so either an enol or an enolate attacks an aldehyde. So here's an aldehyde, and you can make an enolate here and attack that aldehyde. Okay, can you see a possible problem? Shirley? Ah, there's another enolate. It could have gone that way too and given the wrong thing. But they were lucky this time. If they hadn't been lucky, they would have figured some other thing to do. And many they don't tell you about all the things that fail in these syntheses typically. They make believe that it all came perfectly out of their mind from the beginning. But in fact, often they have to try lots of different things to make sure that they get what they want. But anyhow, they were lucky in this case and it gave the right ring. Okay, and then they have to change this into an ester, so you just oxidize it with any old oxidizing agent you know will do an aldehyde. They use chromate. And then they wanted it to be an ester. So how are you going to make an acid into an ester? Yeah? You could make an acid chloride, then treat it with methanol, say, or ethanol, something like that. Okay? But this stuff is getting pretty precious. There have been lots of steps to get here. You want to get the cleanest, highest possible yield out of this. Do you remember how to get an ester with the highest possible yield? Don, did you have that idea? Diazomethane. We mentioned that. That's a minor thing, but that's what they used. Because then you get 100% yield. So they got the ester here. Okay, so now we're pretty close. We got A, B, C, D. All we have to do is get these couple functional groups and that ketone in there. Okay, so the first thing they did was change. This looks like a step backwards. They had the ketone, and now they've made it into an alcohol again. Right? And they used borohydride to reduce the ketone here without touching the ester. Lithium aluminum hydride would have gotten both of them. Right? But by using borohydride, they get just this one. Okay, and then the reason they took a step backwards was it had been shown in 1909 that these kinds of steroid alcohols can be separated as to whether this OH is up or down. Now, they don't care whether it's up or down because it's got to go back to be a ketone anyhow. But the thing that's used to separate it is this, digitonin, which is a whole bunch of sugars attached to a steroid. So this is complicated stuff. But if you treat a mixture of this with this digitonin in 90% ethanol, then it turns out that one of those will precipitate and not the other, the two OHs up and down. But this stuff is, of course, optically active. It's a single enantiomer. It comes from nature. So it makes a difference whether this thing is right-handed or left-handed. Remember when we put that methyl group on there, we didn't know whether it was up or down. There are going to be two enantiomers of this stuff we're making, right? But this allows precipitating one of them. So they precipitated it three times with this and then got the isomer of this they wanted, but of course threw away a lot of material in the process. The wrong isomers, okay? And then they used H2 and a catalyst. And I'm going to show you this. Because this conversion was known already from lots of people, as I said, had been studying cortisone. Reichstein, Kendall at the Mayo Clinic, and people at Merck and all sorts of places. People had been doing different conversions involving cortisone. So people already knew that if you had this, then you could get to cortisone, right? So this total synthesis was not total in a sense. It's called a formal total synthesis or a relay synthesis. You get to something that you know could be made into the product. So if you had enough of that stuff, you could have made the product. But the amount of this they had, they don't say. But you can bet it was about this much, right? Not enough to do all these transformations. But those transformations were known. So this was a formal total synthesis, a relay synthesis. And this is the paper, that's the whole paper that describes the end of this synthesis, the total synthesis of cortisone. Because they'd made a lot of this stuff before, so here's that H2 and PD, so it reduces this one. Notice it reduces here and reduces here, but doesn't reduce there. Okay. Then sodium borohydride reduces this back again. They had oxidized, they're back again here. They're fiddling around. Okay. And it does, but the borohydride doesn't get this, or probably gets this, but doesn't get the ester. Right? Then they acetylate down here. And then they convert this the rest of the way. And we'll just look at this. At this point, our synthetic work intersects lines previously laid down in the extensive prior investigations by many groups, and they go through it. So they say Hyman and Fieser, the Fieser that we looked at in the first slide, had shown that you could get convert 3 to 5. So reference 4 here shows that you can get that ketone now where you want it. If you had that double bond here, it's possible that they'd shown that you could get that ketone where you wanted it and get the ketone there. Okay, then you can go from there by stuff that Reichstein had done and make this into the acetate here. Then you can do this, which had been done by Reichstein again, the guy who got the Nobel Prize. That puts this stuff on here, and then Sarat at Merck had done this and found a way to put the OH on there. So you're home, right? They've got it. Oh, his last one, last. Kendall, the other guy that got the Nobel Prize, was able to do that, to get the double bond back here. Okay, so the intellectual problem was solved, right? They had made a total synthesis, although there was no single atom that went all the way from starting material to product because they had stopped and done a relay. Okay, but what was the yield? They don't say. Okay, not enough to replace other sources of cortisone. So, if you do a sequential synthesis, which is this, you take something, make it into the next thing, make it into the next thing, make it into the next thing. As you know from lab, 80% yield isn't bad. Would you agree? From what you've done in lab? I mean, you want to get 99% yield or 100, but pretty often you don't. So if you did 40 steps at 80% yield, the overall yield is 0.01%. Okay, but there's another way to design syntheses, and we'll show one of these in just a second, which is called a convergence synthesis, where you do much shorter, not 40 steps, but you do 4 different preparations, each of 9 steps, and then you do 2 more steps to put those pieces together. So you do a lot of stuff in parallel rather than sequentially. then you get a 9% overall yield. So you start from stuff and do 9 steps to get A, B, C, and D. Then you put A with B and C with D. And then you put E with F, and you have the product. And that will give, if you get 80% yield for each transformation, that gives you 9%, which is a heck of a lot better than 0.01%, 1,000 times better. Okay? Now, how about a practical synthesis? The important thing, as Reichstein mentioned in his Nobel address, was to choose an appropriate, readily available starting material. Okay, so here's desoxycholic acid, which you get from ox bile. So Merck, in between 1946 and 1949, had made a kilogram of cortisone, starting with 600 kilograms of this thing that they get from the slaughterhouse. Okay, and you can see what's good. It's got the right rings, properly methylated, methyl here, here, methyl here, here. It's got the right stereochemistry. It's got functional groups where you need them, at least at some of the proper positions. Right? But you're going to have to do something to cut this down and make it into that. Right? So you could imagine things. This isn't what they did, but they did a lot of steps, 12 steps and then 20 steps in order to get this over to there. Right? So you could imagine doing a bromination here because tertiary brominates more rapidly than primary and secondary. You could imagine doing that. You could imagine then eliminating to get that double bond, then cleaving it, ozonolysis, to make a carbonyl. Then you could imagine putting alpha bromines in, right, and changing those into alcohols over here. So you could imagine kinds of things to try, but they did lots of different stuff that they had to do in order to do that. Okay. So they were selling it in 1949 for $200 a gram. But there's a stuff called diazoxanone, which also is a pretty, it's got the right rings put together right, the right stereochemistry. It's got functional groups where you need them. And it's very abundant in a yam that grows in Mexico. Cabeza de Negro is the name of it. And this chemist from Penn State went down there to look for things that had it and found this and established and found out that you could convert it in 5 steps to progesterone, which is itself a valuable thing, pregnancy hormones. He could make that for 48 cents a gram. And then this has still got this problem. How are you going to get that thing in there? You don't have any handles, right? But it was found by people at Upjohn, where this guy was an alumnus of Yale, was the research director, that a microbiological oxidation will do that. You know, stuff started growing on this stuff, and you looked and it had that ketone in there. Right, there's a fish jumping into the boat. Okay. And then in only 7 steps they could get to there. So this is much better than that other way. Plus you can get a ton of it from these yams in Mexico. So he became a very important pioneer and founded Syntex, which became a big pharmaceutical corporation. Now, and then synthetic chemists. So that's the practical aspect. And the stuff became, you know, now I was going to go to our medicine chest. I'm sure we've got some hydrocortisone cream in there. You know, probably, do you guys have hydrocortisone? You know, you buy it. It doesn't cost anything now. Right. Okay, so here's Woodward, and here's Eschenmoser. And these two guys at ETH Zurich and at Harvard put their research groups together to tackle this one, which is really tough, vitamin B12. And in the process, they had 100 co-workers working with them on this, the best chemists that in the world, probably, the whole bunch of them. Right? And during this work, Woodward discovered the control of stereochemistry by orbital symmetry. So all this stuff about conrotation and disrotation was developed, invented, while they were working on the synthesis of this. Okay? And those co-workers included this guy, who was a postdoctoral from an instructor at Nagoya University, but he came and worked as a postdoctoral with Woodward. And Woodward wrote about him in context of doing this stuff about vitamin B12. This first preparation of chorogenolide, the stuff here, afforded striking testimony to the experimental skill of its discoverer, Dr. Yoshito Kishi. All of the operations had to be conducted with every conceivable precaution in respect to purity of reagents, exclusion of oxygen, moisture, and with the greatest possible speed. So Kishi was really a wizard in the lab, right? And he then joined Woodward as a colleague at Harvard as a professor, and then succeeded him as the main. Well, actually, there are three really good physical synthetic organic chemists at Harvard, but Kishi was among the best, and he was the one who was that most obvious successor of Woodward. So in 1994, Kishi synthesized paletoxin, this molecule, which is C123, etc. 42 functional groups, they were protected 8 different ways, right? All those stereo centers he had to get right. Right, and plus the cis trans double bond, they're 10^20 stereoisomers of this. But he made it convergent, so he made 8 pieces: this green piece, this piece, 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 and then put them together. You could never make something so big by sequential operation, so it's convergent the way we talked about. Okay, and then we mentioned this last semester, that this is an actual drug being tested and in final stages of testing by, I didn't check, but it must be just about done, by Eisai Pharmaceutical. I remember we talked about this last semester, that has 100,000 configuration isomers, but they're making it by total synthesis, not by starting with some yam and modifying it, right? And notice that the leader of this group is Kishi. So this has all come through this tradition from Woodward and so on. And so organic synthesis has come a long way from urea. You remember this? He wrote to Berzelius in 1828. Perhaps you remember the experiment I carried out when I was working with you, found that whenever one tries to react cyanic acid with ammonia, a crystalline substance appears, which is inert, behaving neither like cyanate nor like ammonia. But nowadays, people can make almost anything. So there's a lot of lore you have to master to do it, but it's really an art, and the people who do it consider it art, but not many people are able to appreciate it the way they can appreciate paintings by Rembrandt, but you've learned enough maybe to appreciate some of it at least. So I'll be here on Monday if you guys want to ask any questions. That'll be my review session, and good luck. Thank you. My pleasure. And we'll have the TAs are going to do some review sessions. Well, I guess the best thing is, should we email you about, or did you guys want to ask some questions about when they might be available?
Yeah, so it's something that we're writing. When do you want to have a review session?
Or are there things that a lot of you are in, so you couldn't possibly come to a review session the night before that or something like that? I mean, we'll have a number of sessions so that you can't come to them all, obviously, but we want to be able to accommodate everybody somehow. Hassan, what do you say? Let's see. I'll let these guys control this.
Is it my regular session will be on Monday as a review section? His regular session will be on Thursday as a review section, and you can also do something Wednesday, something bigger. Do you like Wednesday?
And Connie, are you people planning to do Sunday again or? Not? Yeah. Okay. So we'll.
I need to schedule a makeup session, but I didn't have a review session last week. So would that work best for you guys Saturday?
Tuesday night.